honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is Tom Davis. He'll celebrate his 90th birthday this September in Grover Beach, California, where we recorded this episode out on his front patio. So if you hear the occasional bird or his dog Annie, or perhaps even the Pacific Ocean just a stone's throw away, that is why. If you've ever gone skiing at the China Peak Ski Resort, you've taken advantage of something that Tom built. More on that later, but he wouldn't have had that opportunity if he did not survive a near-death experience near the 38th parallel in Korea nearly 70 years ago. You heard him explain how an enemy mortar shell left him with injuries in his back, chest, arms, and legs. He was left for dead. After coming to, he started crawling, and eventually he was spotted by the last American soldier in the area and helped to safety. One thing I was wondering, as you told that story, Tom, and I'm sure some of the listeners at home were as well, could you feel the impact of that mortar blast, or were you just knocked out immediately?
I was out immediately. I mean, I felt nothing. I felt I was on my way to heaven, and this is the honest to God truth, because I felt that I was on my way, and it was a sort of a long white trail, and just heading up that way, and all of a sudden somebody says, I can't come in, and so I had to go back. And so I know there's a God, and so I know there's a God, and I know there's something in the next world that I'm going to see when I go. I'm going to see it, because I know there's something there that I didn't get to see. And I came back, and the first thing that my eyes opened up, I said, oh, my God, I'm alive. I thought I was dead all the time. I experienced death, and it was kind of an very interesting. It was peaceful. I didn't have any pain at all. I didn't have any pain until I came to, and I didn't even have any pain until I crawled off the hill, and until the guy picked me up and tried to help me get going. Then the pain came, because the leg was killing me, and the pain started coming, and I just collapsed. I mean, I couldn't go anymore. I mean, I couldn't help myself. And it was kind of crazy, and I didn't have any pain until then. And I didn't see any blood on me or anything like that, but they said I'd have bled to death, they said, if it was warmer.
So when you come to, I mean, how do you make sense of the reality that you're in? I mean, you don't know if there's enemy out there, if your guys are around. What's that process like when you come to and you're trying to figure out what's going on?
Well, the first thing I did was when I come to, I got to get out of this mess I'm in, you know, and I started crawling down the hill, and I knew I got to get back to that river, as I remembered. And so I was crawling right for that, and I was trying to head for the tanks that I remember seeing when I was in combat, when the fighting started and tanks were shooting overhead fire. There were six tanks out there, and I knew that they were there, and so I got to crawl that, and that'd be my only way out of here, because I couldn't, there wasn't anybody else around. And I came around the corner there, and here the guy said, oh my God, we left you for dead. And I said, I'm not dead. Yeah. So I put my arm around him, and he tries to, we walk across the creek, river there, and we got to go on the other side. And then I collapsed on the other side, and he says, get up. And I said, I can't get up. I can't walk on the leg. And he said, and he couldn't carry me. So I looked up, and I see these guys coming running from the tank, and they have a litter in their hands, and they got over there, and they put me on the litter and hauled me all the way back to the tank, and then put me on top of the tank. And I don't even remember getting off the tank, and I don't even remember getting off the tank or where the tank went when I passed out when I was on top of the tank, I guess. And the next thing I know, I was laying on the ground, and there was about 8 or 10 guys laying there, wounded too, right alongside of me, you know, and they're cutting my clothes off. And I said, well, how bad is it? And he said, oh, it's not bad at all. I said, you mean I got to come back? And he says, no, you're not coming back. You got a stateside wound. And I said, wow. I couldn't believe that, you know, because a lot of the guys had to come back sometimes to get wounded in the foot or something like that, and then they'd just fix him up and they'd bring him back out the field again. They'd shoot, and he'd be out there and get himself shot again. And it's not fun to have to come back to the combat zone and experience it again. Not exciting at all. It's scary, and I don't wish that on anybody.
I don't know if you've ever thought about this. What do you think would have happened to you if that guy wasn't there, if he didn't see you and help you as far as he did?
You asked that question, and I know what I felt, that if I hadn't have been, I'd have crawled as far as I could gone, but I know damn well I would have probably been killed by the enemy. They would have found me, and because I couldn't have crawled across the field that far. It was a good quarter of a mile to the tank, and they wouldn't have seen me crawling on the ground, because I was just crawling. When I got to the creek, that's when he was. There was 200 of us there, and then he was the only one left. And there was only one guy left, and he hadn't gone across the creek yet. He saw me coming around the corner there, crawling on the ground. And I was crawling as fast as I could crawl. And I probably would have died probably by the time I got to the tank, because it was another quarter of a mile away. And they wouldn't have seen me crawling across the field in that brush. It was rice paddies. It was what it was across there I had to get through. But no, I thought about it several times. If I hadn't found somebody there, that I probably would have been killed by the enemy.
Or even if it took you 5 or 10 minutes longer to come to, by that time, all those guys would have been gone.
Yes, he would have been gone. Everybody was gone. There was only one guy left, and he was straggler, and he was ready to cross the creek when he saw me.
Do you remember that guy's name, the guy who found you?
You know, I don't know who he was, and I wished I did. It was hard to recognize anything at that time. It was very difficult. I couldn't see how badly I was wounded, because I was sort of still delirious. It was tough.
And you'd been there 3 months by now, so had you dealt with losing friends of yours, losing guys that you had served with?
Oh, yes. One of the guys was in my basic training. I asked him where he was, and they said he got killed yesterday. And I said, oh, no, my God. Somebody's got to call his parents and let them know. It was very disturbing, because I went through basic training with him, and he was in combat, and he hadn't been there long enough to even know what the hell the war was all about, you know, and he was killed. It was sad to see somebody get hurt. There's not much you can do, though. I mean, you do the best you can do and try to hang on. I know I made some decisions that I tried to stay alive. That was the main thing I tried to do, but it was tough. It was damn tough. No one knows how tough it is until you ride into that combat. And the enemy doesn't care, and he's going after you. So you've got to be on your toes, or otherwise you're going to be killed. I mean, I don't know how anybody makes it through the damn thing.
Well, and you said you're convinced you would have died had that soldier not been there right when you crawled to that point. And I guess the likelihood is your body might still be over there, because there are thousands of American servicemen who their remains have not been brought home yet from that war yet, and people are still working on that. But what I wonder is, when you're in the hospital, when you're starting to take stock of your wounds, was there any fear or concern in your mind that you might not make it, or that your life would be drastically impacted by these injuries?
Once I got wounded, you know, you're in a tent hospital. I was in and out because I was doped up quite a bit, so I didn't have much of a remembrance of that, because I was unconscious and out of it. But when they put me on the train and shipped me down to Seoul, there was other soldiers on that train. And I know I was on the bottom bunk, and the guy above me was there, and we were talking to each other. I said, I hope the hell I don't have to come back. And he said, I don't want to come back. That's no fun up here. And so when I got back to Seoul, I go to the hospital. They take us in. They carry me in on a litter, and they open the door. And from the beginning of the hospital door to the far end, as far as I could see, there was bodies on the floor, just hundreds of them. They were waiting to get in to see a doctor, and that's where I was placed. I fall asleep again. The next thing you know, somebody's waking me up into the operating room. That must be midnight or so. And I had, and I'll never forget this as long as I live. It was the oddest thing to have. I had all my clothes taken off, and then I was wrapped up in blankets and stuff, but I had my hand, and I had my wallet in my hand. We only made $3 a day when you get $90 a month and something like that. And you get in combat, they give you combat pay, $50 a month combat pay extra. So I had a $100 bill in my wallet, and I had my wallet in my hand, and I put it there. And the doctor, I can remember this day, he says, can I have that wallet? And I said, no. And I would not give it to him, you know. And he said, it's okay. That's no problem. And then I wake up after this the surgery and everything else, and they had a cast on my leg. I felt my chest, my wallet's taped to my chest. I said, oh, what a fool you were. They took it away while I was out, and then they put it back on and taped it to me. It was so funny to find my wallet was taped to my chest with all the shrapnel they took out of me. And he said, the doctor walked by, and he says, boy, I didn't know that you shotguns over there. And I said, what do you mean? He said, you hit everywhere. And I said, well, it doesn't feel good today. It was better. I had a cast on my leg and everything else, but it was kind of strange. And then they package you all up again on the cast. They mark where your wounds are because you're not going to stay there in that hospital, because that's all that hospital's for, is to take your patients in and get them out as fast as possible, because they're getting them in by the day, hundreds of them coming in. So they had to get me out and fly me to Japan. I didn't know it at the time, but they mark on the cast there where the wounds are, so the next doctor can look at the cast and say, okay, there's a wound down here, goes through his leg and so forth. But anyway, they fly me to Kobe, Japan, and I go to the hospital there, but my temperature wouldn't go down. And the doctor kept coming in and says, what are you eating? I said, no, I'm not eating anything. I'm not agreeing with it. That was about 3 days, I think maybe 3 or 4 days before they decided they better cut the cast off and see if there's anything there. Well, you can't blame the doctors in combat, you know. They do the best they can with what they got to work with as quick as they can. So when they put a cast on my leg, they marked that where the shrapnel went through my bone, and they marked that circle, but they didn't mark the shrapnel that went into my foot. And so when they cut the cast off, the pus just went everywhere. And they said, oh, my God, he's got another wound somewhere. And so that's why he's having so much trouble. Every day they'd have to take the cast off and drain that wound bound there, you know. And the Japanese nurses were sort of dainty. They didn't want to hurt you, and they'd be just as dainty as they possibly could. But it's still painful. And so they'd squeeze it and, you know, and let the – it was terrible. Anyway, maybe 5 days went by, and one day it came by, and I said, oh, man, they forgot me. I get to get by today without, they won't be doing this, because it was painful to have them do that, you know. And about noon, the pain was starting to throb, and the foot was starting to really go to hell. And so I had to pull the buzzer, and the head nurse was an American, and she was in charge of all the Japanese nurses. She says, that's your foot, nobody else's foot. And if you don't tell them to take care of it, nobody else is going to take care of it for you. And she grabbed that damn thing, and everybody in the place said, Tom, don't kick her. You know, I mean, she was just mad as hell at me. She went, bam, she was, what the hell's that? And I said, what do you mean? She said, what popped out? It looks like part of your boot. She pops this part of my boot out of my heel that was in there, and the infection was in there, and then it was just running all over the place. And she said, well, my God. She said, maybe we got it all out of there, you know, and it's going to start to heal. And it did. It started healing from then. I was there 3 months before I could leave that area to come home. And they couldn't let me go unless they got the infection all out, you know. But they didn't know what was causing it until she got mad at me, and she just squeezed so hard, tired. And I mean, I was almost going to kick her. But once that came out, then things started to heal. So then they could package me up and ship me out of there and send me home. And I landed up in Hawaii, and I spent a week in Hawaii, and I told them they'd leave me here. I was happy as hell there. And they said, no, you're going to go to El Paso, Texas. And I said, what do you mean? I don't live in El Paso. And they said, well, that's the nearest hospital that can take care of your problems. I was shipped down to William Beaumont Hospital in Texas. And that is one nice hospital. I mean, they had all the facilities in the world. They had these tubs that you can get into, circulate around to get the circulation going again. I was laying on the bed in there, and I'll never forget this either, because the doctors, they come by. Head doctors have interns learning the procedure and everything else, and he came along to my bed, and he says, these are things we've got to do for him. And I giving me his pill, because that his foot keeps sweating, and we're trying to get something to solve the problem. And I said, I opened my drawer, and I said, there's your pills. And he said, well, what are you doing? And I said, I'm in the swimming pool and over the gymnasium, and I'm doing all the exercises I can possibly do. And he said, nurse, come back here. And she said, I want him to have the run of the hospital. He said, can do anything he wants, or he wants to get well. And he said, 5 bunks down, he said, that guy doesn't want to get well, and he'll never walk right, ever. He got injured on a motorcycle, and this guy got wounded. He said, from that time on, I had to run to the hospital. I could go swimming pool every day and go in the gym. I got well in 5 months. I spent 5 months down there, and then they sent me back to active duty. I had to be light duty, and so they put me in the post office. So at that time, I didn't like noises at all. They'd have their music on when I come in the post office. They'd have it on pretty loud, and I'd tell them to turn it down, and they did. They didn't want to bother me at all. They said, he has a problem. He doesn't like noises, and I didn't. It was hard for a while.
You point that out, that they recognized in you this desire to recover, to get back to normal, if that's possible. Where did that come from? What prevented you from getting depressed, giving up, thinking your life was never going to be the same? What was it that kept you focused on getting better?
I think that I enjoyed life before I went in the service, and so and I wanted to get back into racing or something. I wanted to get back to my friends again. I really enjoyed life, mainly because I saw where I wasn't really worried about dying ever again, because I knew where I was going when I got wounded, and that outer experience, you might say, seeing a pathway to heaven, I knew I was nothing to worry about. So from that time on, I wanted to enjoy what life I do have left. But that's the way I felt about it. Without that, I don't know if I'd have done as well if I hadn't experienced that out-of-death experience. I have people come by the house here, they're ministers and stuff like that, and say, you don't have to talk to me about God. I know all about him. And I don't have a problem with going to see him again or anything. I mean, it's very pleasant. It's kept me going most of my life, knowing the fact that it's not that bad. I know a lot of people. I know this young lady, it's my caretaker. She's been taking care of me. She lost her son in a motorcycle accident, and she just went to pieces. But I said, he's in heaven. He's enjoying life up there. I said, don't worry about him. You'll see him when you go up there. So I really feel that that's the way it is, because what I saw and what I've experienced and over there in combat, it gave me a good different life to look at, you know. So I've been real comfortable with my life ever since. I had a good life at Shaver Lake. My life was there. As a boy, I spent most of my summers up there in the Sierras.
Well, and I'm guessing there are a lot of people listening right now who have benefited from some of your handiwork. Did you really help build the chairlift at China Peak Ski Resort?
Yes, I did. I did most of the welding on it, on the towers. From there on out, I put the shivs all on when they went bankrupt, and I bought the blower, and then I went into snow business and did a lot of snow removal up there. And
it's been more than 65 years since you were wounded, and some have called the war you were in, the Korean War, they've called it the Forgotten War. Have there been times in all the years since that you felt that way, that you felt people didn't understand or appreciate what you and all those other Americans did there?
Yes, I did. I don't think that anybody realizes what war is all about anyway. It doesn't matter whether it's a Korean War, Vietnam War, or whatever, you know. World War II was bad enough, but they got celebrating everywhere, New York and everywhere else. But when I went to Honor Flight, that Honor Flight was well worth while going on, because we were honored and for something we never got honored for. Because when we came back home, nobody cared. They talked more about Vietnam than they ever talked about Korea, and they didn't honor us at all. So it was kind of nice to go on the honor flight. That was an honor and a half. Everywhere we went, we were honored.
And thanks again to Paul James, Tom's guardian, on that sentimental journey to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Central Coast, California, for suggesting we get to know his neighbor here on Hometown Heroes. I'm so glad we've had that privilege today. Tom Davis, thank you so much for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your one-of-a-kind story. You'll find a few photos of Tom's trip to the Korean War Veterans Memorial and other sites in our nation's capital that you can explore at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. That's all the time we have today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.